Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory, paint the breeze.
I think in Mississippi, where a lawyer or a judge is requiring everybody to do the Pledge of Allegiance, which I think he shouldn't do, although there are judges, and we had one here in San Francisco, Kevin Ryan, who was on the San Francisco City County Court bench, who didn't have the American flag displayed. Of course, he was born in Canada and lied about it, did a lot of other things. But anyway, you know, you don't have to brag about your allegiance to the United States. It's how you act, how you vote, how you take an interest in your community, your country, how you respect your fellow human being, your neighbor, how you donate to reputable charities or even donate. I mean, people donate to foreign countries when there's a disaster, even though they don't like their politics, don't like their government. But Americans are the most generous people in the world, and we're still not appreciated for. In every disaster in the history of this country that this country has recognized, Russia, China, earthquakes, Indonesia, South America, Mexico, Americans have gone into their cupboards, they've gone into their closets, they've gone into their checkbooks and helped these countries, even though we didn't like their governments. So I think it's important. This week is significant because it's also the 100th anniversary of the Canadian Navy. I was looking for my file copy of a ship that the British claimed that they invented it, but it was, I believe, the Canadians. You know, we don't give Canada much credit for a lot of things they've done, and coming up on our Amicus Veritas YouTube site, AmicusVeritas, we'll have a salute to, it's called O Canada, and the contributions that Canadians have made to the American military and who have served, people like Glenn Ford. A lot of people don't know that he was born in Quebec. I don't think he was Catholic, and maybe he was, fell away. But he grew up in Santa Monica, California, joined the Marines in World War II, and he died. He lived a long life. He was a captain in the U.S. Navy Reserve, but he had served in the U.S. Marines. A lot of Canadians and even Americans have gone up to Canada in 1940 and tried to enlist in the Canadian Army. And we hear about the Eagle Squadron. These were Americans who went to Britain to fly in the Royal Air Force, the RAF. And, of course, there's a famous movie with Tyrone Power, who was an American, Irish ethnicity. Great movie. You should catch it. And there's a lot of great movies of World War II that are coming out, and we'll be talking about them. Some of them very relevant to the subjects that I try to talk about every week on the Blog Talk and on Amicus Veritas, our YouTube site, and on our website, amicusveritas.org, and related. What's significant about Fleet Week is that this particular one is that 10 years ago, Stephen Neri was put on trial, a U.S. Navy sailor who had been abused in San Francisco's jail and at courts. He was removed from a ship through a fraudulent document signed by a employee, Peter Kling of the San Francisco District Attorney's Office, a real slime ball, who suddenly seems to have a lot of real estate wealth. Over 100 real estate transactions that we've tracked. I don't know what's going on. Maybe he came into some money or inherited something. We have been unable to verify how these transactions have come about, but we're working on it. But anyway, Steve fought off a guy who lured him to a remote area of San Francisco. It's on the website. But during Fleet Week of 1999, this corrupt Canadian-born judge, Kevin Ryan, and corrupt district attorney Terrence Allen and his assistant, John Farrell, Bathhouse John, who injected his gay political agenda into the trial, the kangaroo court trial, and invented bathhouses next to the high school down in Southern California that Steve Neri had attended. And they timed this kangaroo court trial for Fleet Week of 1999. And they put the U.S. Navy and the Marine Corps on trial. And here, these young guys and these young women are serving on our ships and on foreign shores, wearing the uniform, wearing it honorably, ready to shed their blood, lose their limbs, and give up their lives to protect us here at home. And here are these slime balls who are on the public payroll and getting all kinds of benefits, low-income housing, big health benefits, big long vacations, fat fringe benefits, and fat retirements, and this is how our servicemen and women get treated, put on trial as homophobic and racist and all of that. But that's why this is significant. And, their karma's catching up with them. And of course, the morons in the media, and these are the people who attended that trial and who lied, distorted, and omitted. And it goes on across the country. And there was an interesting editorial, which we will put up in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. We have a copy, and they're talking about what I have been saying and others have been saying, that the courts of the United States across the country, whether on the state, federal appellate, or U.S. Supreme Court levels, the courts are out of control, and they're violating those who are supposed to take an oath of office, violating the procedures and manipulating the court procedures and people's rights, plaintiffs and defendants' rights. And they recognize this up at the U.S. Supreme Court, and it happened in the Steve Neri case as well as in other cases. And also we bring up the fact that there's the Norfolk Four. These were four young Navy sailors the same age as Steve Neri, about 18 and 19, not the particular incandescent intellect, that's my phrase, who were accused of murdering and raping this young woman in the apartment complex that they lived off base in Norfolk, Virginia. And they had been railroaded, so they say, and their defendants say, into a Virginia state prison. And we're still trying to get a lot of the information about what really happened, and there seemed to be a lot of cover-up. And then there's the case of Tim Masters, which was featured on CBS's 48 Hours, where another 18-year-old Navy sailor was falsely accused by a Fort Collins cop of murdering and raping a woman who was much bigger than he was. He was a little kid, 18 years old, just in the Navy, and he was railroaded into a Colorado state prison for about 14 years. They finally exonerated him. Unfortunately, they didn't disbar and prosecute the two corrupt prosecutors in that case. They were appointed judges, and that says something about Colorado's legal profession. Anyway, Fort Collins, I think, paid about $4 to $5 million compensation to Tim Masters. Of course, that'll never be repaid for the 14 years of his young life that he spent in a prison for a crime he didn't commit. And then there's, of course, the Steve Nery case, which we talk about frequently, and it's been repeatedly up on the web. More and more people are asking questions. I would recommend to you, especially California people who are concerned about what's going on in the great state of California, to get Jack Cashel's book. It's still available from his website or from Amazon, called What's the Matter with California? Now, the book does not give the entire, it doesn't give a lot of the what really happened in the Steve Nery case, because some of that stuff was, I would say, national security. It wasn't, we didn't get a lot of the documents that were withheld, but a lot of the stuff has been, we've been able to get it and release it and disseminate it. But anyway, it gives you a good overview of what really happened in this kangaroo court trial, because I gave the documents to Cashel when he was researching that part of the book. The book, per se, is not about Steve Nery. It's about what's going on in California and why the state has become so dysfunctional. Now, interestingly, the editor of the book was Mary Matlin, who is the wife, a lot of people don't know this, the wife of the raging Cajun, Jim Carville. And one of the reasons we didn't and couldn't release information we had at the time, it wasn't all the information, we've got more now, was because the fear was if too much stuff got out about what really happened, that the book would have been squashed. It would never have been published, so erred on the side of a lot of caution in that case. and then, of course, the Nery case is particularly interesting because today is the birthday of Juan Perón, who was the dictator, the neo-Nazi dictator of Argentina, which is connected to this case because of Juan Pifre, who was from Argentina, and his family is connected to the oldest bank, the Bank de Provincia of Buenos Aires. And it's the oldest bank. It goes back to 1822, suspected of holding assets belonging to Europeans. And one thing that we don't always get the full facts about is not only were Jews ripped off in World War II, ripped off by the Nazis, but any country that the Nazi army, the Gestapo, that the Nazis occupied in Europe, they looted everything. They looted artwork, they looted jewelry, they looted cash, they looted gold. And they stole it from everybody. It was you didn't have to be a Jew to be ripped off by the Nazis. Catholics, Protestants, nobility, aristocrats, artists. It was open season, equal opportunity theft. And a lot of that money is suspected, and the assets were suspected of being sent to Argentina, because during World War II, Juan Perón, of all the South American countries, Juan Perón was the one, only one who supported Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo. And that one of the reasons may have been because people still don't realize that South Americans have a lot of not only Spanish and Portuguese blood, but it's English, Italians, Germans, Czechs, French, all went to various countries in South America. And you see some of those names, and even the Irish. In fact, the Irish helped Simon Bolivar kick out the Spanish in the early 18th century. And you see names like O'Banion in Chile. You see names today in the military forces down there, Irish and English names, and these are natives whose ancestors fled or emigrated to those countries for a variety of reasons, for poverty, to flee conscription in their home country, or to flee the Irish famine, or because they were freedom fighters and they ended up like O'Banion in Chile. And there are others. You'll see these names in all these countries in South America. Now, Juan Perón was kicked out. He was his, and of course we had that famous or infamous Broadway show called Evita, and Evita Perón, Evita Duarte. She was we would call her a streetwalker, impoverished, and he worked the streets of Buenos Aires. And Juan Perón, who was older, took a fancy to her and set her up as the First Lady of Argentina. And she claimed to help the Los Camisitas, the shirtless ones. I think I've got my Spanish right. Being a Spanish ethnicity myself, I should watch my language. Anyway, she died of cancer, and they tried to have her canonized as a saint. And there are questions about all the wealth that Juan Perón ripped off, and he was booted out. There was a military coup. He fled to Spain, and then he picked up another woman. And then he came back to Argentina, I think in the 70s, and he set up his wife, his new wife, a young Chichi, as the El Presidenta, or Presidente of Argentina. And then he died. It's interesting. But today is his birthday, and this kind of fits into what we were talking about. Excuse me, still have this bloody cold. Let's get to some of the birthdays. There's some interesting ones, not that many today. In 1869, the first auto was actually built in the United States by a guy named J. Frank Duryea, and this is before Henry Ford. And then, of course, one of the greatest aviators of all time, especially in World War I, Eddie Rickenbacker. He was born today. And if you come to San Francisco, there is a restaurant on 2nd Street, which has an exact replica, or maybe it is a World War I biplane, the type that Eddie Rickenbacker flew in the what they call the Lafayette Escadrille in World War I in France. And there were other Americans who went over there, including Cole Porter. And that's where Cole Porter wrote his famous song, Learn the Music to Begin the Begin and Night and Day. And he met Linda Lee Thomas, who reportedly was a lesbian. And, of course, Cole Porter was gay. But it was what they call, they were both from wealthy families in Indiana. And it's one of those marriages of convenience. And there's a famous movie of the 40s with Cary Grant as Cole Porter and Alexis Smith as his wife. And Monty Woolley, who was an English professor at Yale and was a flamer, he liked to go down to the wharfs in New York and pursue black sailors. And he's in it, and he's playing himself, and he's quite a character. But it's called, the movie's called Night and Day, great music, and Mary Martin makes her debut in that film, My Heart Belongs to Daddy, but not to Cole Porter. These are some people who were in World War I. And then, of course, we have a famous Japanese composer, Toru Takemitsu. Very interesting music, and people don't think that the Japanese could write European-type classical music. But it's interesting that a lot of people don't know, that a lot of Japanese musicians, including the famous Seiji Ozawa, he went to Europe, he persuaded a Japanese, I think Honda, to give him a motorcycle, and he would ride that thing to Europe, and it was good publicity for them in the early 60s. I think that's when he did it, and he ended up in Germany, and he studied with Herbert von Karajan, who's one of the greatest conductors and impresarios and technicians in music. And he went on to come to San Francisco Symphony, and then Boston for about 25 years, and then he's back in Europe. He has stomach cancer, I believe. But musicians were trained in Europe, and it's interesting. New Year's Day in Japan, they always play Beethoven's Ninth. It's just something about those Germans and the Japanese. And then the famous movie, Australian, not Breaker Morant. But Paul Hogan, those of you who like Crocodile Dundee. Now, Paul Hogan's got some trouble with the Australian tax authorities. They were really jamming him. They picked up his passport. He can't leave the country. He has houses in Southern California, I believe, but he owes them, they claim, buku bucks. And so they're not going to let him out of the country until he resolves his Australian revenue debt. He claims he doesn't owe the money. And he's one of the most controversial characters in American politics, and his name's coming up again in the Obama senator scandal, a controversy. Jesse Jackson, or Jesse Jive, as some people call him. Now, Jesse Jackson's very interesting. I met him at the 1984 convention here in San Francisco, which I was covering in part for KLW and Western Public Radio. But Jesse Jackson has an interesting background. Not only is he a sleaze, screwing around with women that are not his wife and having a child, they try to cover that up, but he was supposedly illegitimate. That's not his fault, but he managed to persuade the governor of South Carolina. Remember, this is just around the time of civil rights problems in the South, a lot of controversy and conflicts. And he persuaded the governor of South Carolina, where he was from, to give him a letter of introduction to Mayor Daley in Chicago. Jesse Jackson came up to Chicago, met with Richard Daley, and gave him the letter, and he expected to get some prominent position in the Cook County Democratic machine. Well, Daley told him, this is the story, but that's the way I got it, that okay, you want prominence. You got to work your way up. So he was offered a position, which had a lot of graft, incidentally, on the Illinois toll road to be a revenue collector, in those little boots. And Jesse Jackson was insulted. Well, it turns out that was a mistake on the part of Richard Daley, because Jesse Jackson decided to get even with the machine and started all this agitation in Chicago and with the Cook County machine and in the black community. And, of course, they were ripe. This was a period of the long, hot summer and some of the stuff that I saw as a student. And, we can speculate what might have been had Richard Daley said, okay, we'll give him some slot somewhere and just keep an eye on this guy because we don't really know about him. And he seems a little too ambitious and big for his britches. How history might have been different. But the last time I saw Jesse, I was doing a program for research program, program analyst for one of the federal agencies, and I had to go down to the south side of Chicago to look at Jesse Jackson's Operation Push. Well, when I got down there, it was in a former Catholic church on the south side of Chicago, Corpus Christi, I think it was. Beautiful church, or was. And what I found when I went there was all it was a CB radio to inform people about alleged Chicago police brutality against blacks and a food stamp program. So I went back to the office and just filled out my report and said, basically, it's nothing. There's not even voter registration, at least not when I was there. And so I made a mistake, and I called it Operation Poof. Well, Jesse never forgave me for that, and when I ran into him in the 1984 Democratic Convention here in San Francisco, he gave me the evil eye, and that was that, and I haven't talked to him or, had any contact with him since. But it's interesting. Now, then he's been grooming one of his sons, and he lives quite well, by the way, on the south side of Chicago, like this Reverend Wright, or Irreverend Wright. The son who is a Democratic convention, who is in the Democratic Party and the U.S. representative from one of the districts in Illinois, and who thought he should be the successor to Obama for the U.S. Senate seat. And so there's some questions about, what alleged manipulation maneuvers and if there was any bribery that went on to try to get the seat, to get the appointment for Jesse Jackson Jr. So we shall see how that rolls out. And, of course, I always said Illinois politics are much better and much more brutal and much more colorful than politics out here in California, where there's so many phonies and so many carpetbaggers who come out here and ruin what was once a golden state. They've turned it into a desert, with a lot of their agendas. And, of course, San Francisco now is enjoying the Giants, who are playing in the World Series preliminary playoffs. I think that's what it is. Anyway, I'm not a baseball fan anymore. I was a Cubs fan at one time, but I've grown out of it too slow. Anyway, nobody is paying tribute to the great George Christopher, who was the mayor of San Francisco at the time, who outmaneuvered Los Angeles when he learned that Horace Stoneham, the owner of the New York Giants, was planning to move the Giants out of New York to Los Angeles. And George Christopher went and persuaded Stoneham that he would build a new stadium, which was Candlestick Park, and that to bring the Giants to San Francisco. And because the Giants were tentatively going to go to, I think, Chez Levine. Anyway, I'm going to run that interview because I did do an interview before George Christopher died. He did so much for this country and for this city and for the world. Great mayor, a great businessman, a great human being. And I shall always remember that he was a friend and helped us push Veritas and try to get reform in what was the Paris of America, which has been turned into the pissoir of the country. We'll get into that another day. Let's see. Of actors, there's Chevy Chase, who was born today, and actresses, Sigourney Weaver, who's I think her father was the president of NBC National Broadcasting, and she, I think, is hooked up with Tom Hanks. I think she was in the film A Year of Living Dangerously, if I'm not mistaken. And then of the interesting deaths, and I kind of equate this guy with this president with Obama, Franklin Pierce. He was one of the most good-looking, handsome men. He did serve in the military, which Obama didn't. We don't even know if Obama, Mr. O, registered for the military draft. There's some controversy about that and about this court-martial case involving this colonel who's asking for Obama to produce a real birth certificate and not a certificate of live birth or whatever. Anyway, Franklin Pierce was one of the incompetent presidents, the only president from New Hampshire, and he had a personal tragedy. His only child, a son, was killed, I think, in a horse accident, a carriage accident, and he was one of the most handsome men to hold the office and one of the most incompetent. But he died today in 1869, and I think he was pro-South. 1869, of course, was 4 years after the end of the American Civil War. Then we have an interesting guy. He's known as the Barefoot Boy from Wall Street. He was actually from Indiana, Wendell Lewis Willkie. He was Republican presidential nominee in 1940 against the third term, challenging FDR was running for a third term during World War II. And Welke came from Indiana, and he was an executive financier on Wall Street. In 1944, Willkie tried to get the nomination again, and the Republican salons wouldn't give it to him, or he couldn't muster up enough votes. But it's very interesting because he died in 1944, and just like FDR died. But it's interesting, this is not well known, that FDR, in the interest of coalition government, as like the British and other governments do, was going to put him on the ticket as the vice presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket, even though he was a Republican. What's interesting was that Franklin Roosevelt dumped all of his vice presidential all his vice presidents. John Nance Garner was the first one. He was from Texas, a filthy man, as Roosevelt's daughter, I forgot her first name, Tartum, very funny woman, but had a very sharp tongue. And John Nance Garner was from Texas, and he used to say that the office of vice president wasn't worth a bucket of warm spit. And so Roosevelt dumped him. Then Roosevelt chose Henry Wallace, who was a closet, some think a closet communist or a dupe. He was a Secretary of Agriculture in one of Roosevelt, I think the first Roosevelt administration. Roosevelt put him on the ticket for the second term, and then he didn't work out, and then I guess they thought he was a parlor pink. That's a closet communist. That's a term I think would be accurate. And so FDR dumped him, and FDR didn't know who to pick. And at the time, during the middle of the war in 1944, Harry Truman was a U.S. senator from Missouri, and he had served honorably in World War I. He was a captain, artillery captain, and he was the chairman of a committee that was overseeing alleged fraud in the military contracts. And he was doing a good job exposing fraud, a lot better than they're doing today in Congress. Anyway, FDR had never met Truman, but he had heard about him, and it was a wise decision, I think, because Truman may disagree with him, but he was a man of a firm backbone, put it that way. So Wallace got dumped, and he was not related to George Wallace, by the way, although that's the same Scottish clan name. And so Harry Truman became the vice presidential nominee for the third term of FDR. But it's interesting that FDR and Wendell Willkie both died in 1944. Had Willkie become the nominee and had been elected president, it would have been interesting to see who his vice presidential running mate would have been. So it's an interesting historical speculation. These are the things that make life funny. And also, this is interesting. It's got a Hollywood connection and also a Look magazine connection. In 1994, Frederick Brisson, Frenchman, who was a great director and the husband, a lot of people don't know this, of famous actress Rosalind Russell. Their son was Lance Brisson. Now, in 1969, Look magazine was still being published, and they published an article with Tucker Anderson's father, who was the a UPI correspondent here in San Francisco. They published a expose on political corruption in San Francisco, in which they tied then-Mayor Joseph Alioto, and it had come up before, actually, in 1968, there were allegations that Joe Alioto, who had vice presidential aspirations, that Joe Alioto was connected to the mafia. And I remember covering that convention, from a different perspective, that was the word at the time, and Joe Alioto, who was mayor of San Francisco at the time, didn't get the nod from Hubert Humphrey. Instead, it went to Eagleton, senator from Missouri, who turned out they didn't do a thorough vetting, and that he was Catholic, and he had had I won't say mental problems, but he had some psychiatric counseling, but that's fair to say, and didn't reveal it, and so they dumped him, or forced him off, just said, you got to go, and so Humphrey chose Muskie, who was actually a Polish ethnic, who had been governor of Maine and a Roman Catholic. And he got the nod, and he became the choice for vice president on the Hubert Humphrey, the Humphrey Muskie ticket. And some people were joking at the time that is a Muskie a new fish? So that's what happened there. But anyway, Lance Brisson wrote this article for Look magazine with Tucker Anderson's father. I think it's Robert Anderson was his first name. Anyway, the hit piece came out. Joe Alioto was furious. He sued Look magazine, claiming defamation and all that libel. And he put Look magazine out of business, but he didn't dispel the suspicion that he was connected to the American mafia. People in San Francisco, the cognoscenti here, said he was not mafia. But they raised some other questions, which we'll not get into at this time because I don't have the article in front of me. But it's a rare article. We have copies, and we'll get into that some more. But this is very interesting. Now, what happened was these guys, Anderson Pear, the father of Tucker, didn't lose credibility. He became a U.S. ambassador, and he ran, I think in the Reagan administration, the United States Information Agency. and was ambassador, named ambassador to some Pacific island. And then Lance Persaud became a radio producer for public broadcasting, or NPR. I don't know what he's doing today. And then his mother, she had cancer, and she there's a famous picture of her in one of the hospitals where they had the story was they had shot a lot of gold into her butt because they were trying to cure her or make her handle, be able to endure the pain from the arthritis. And she's dead now, and so is Frederick Brisson. Brisson did some great films also, but not that many. And then we had, this is the only guy, the only assassination, modern assassination, in which an opera has been written. It's not that good. Leon Klinghoffer was a man in a wheelchair who was on a cruise on an Italian ship called the Achille Lauro. And some terrorists took it over and found out that he was Jewish. And they terrorized the passengers on the ship and decided to push him off the ship. So an opera was composed. I've never heard it, but I understand it's an unfortunate subject, but it's not that outstanding. It's not a thing that the ranks with Aida or Turandot or De Gotterdam. You know, it's a De Gotterdamerung rung for some people. I think they captured the terrorists. But it's just unfortunate, just outrageous that this man was confined to a wheelchair and pushed overboard by these terrorists for no good reason, only because of his religion. And so I think it's something about, but it's Klinghoffer is the name. And those of you who are interested may want to look at that. And then here's some interesting events. So those of you who are interested in boxing and sports, again, in 1818, this was the first time that two English boxers used padded gloves to beat each other to pieces in the ring. Now, what's interesting, one of the great films that are anti-boxing, The Harder They Fall, was Humphrey Bogart's last film, and it has an Argentinian connection that they had this Bull of the Pampas, I think that's what he was called. They used this guy in a rigged boxing match to throw the boxing match, and Humphrey Bogart was taking a bribe, I think, or somebody was. And anyway, the whole thing got spiked, but the boxer was beat to hell, and he got a pile of money and was put on a plane and sent back to Argentina before the mob could get to him. But that was also Humphrey Bogart's last film, and it was very anti-boxing. And those of you who are anti-boxing might want to check out the film The Harder They Fall. And then in 1896, what's relevant to our financial situation today, Dow Jones started the first reporting of the stocks and bonds. And then, of course, I refer you to another film, which is important. It just came out called Katyn, K-A-T-Y-N. Now, when Hitler was doing his manipulations, and Hitler didn't trust Stalin, Stalin didn't trust Hitler, but, you know, politics creates strange littermates is one of my phrases. They made a deal called the Berlin-Moscow Pact with the two foreign ministers, Ribbentrop for Hitler, Molotov for Stalin, made this deal to carve up Poland in two pieces. The eastern half went to the Russians. They moved in there with their army. And the western half was taken over by the Nazis. Well, what Stalin did, the Polish army had been defeated in September of 1939, and Stalin had his own long-range plans to take over Poland and make it communist. So they had the Polish military, which was a fine military, but they didn't have the equipment. They had cavalry fighting tanks. But they did invent the Ultra Machine. It was two Polish mathematicians. Those machines did not end up in the hands of the Germans. They ended up they were taken to Britain. And the Ultra Secret was one of the top secrets of the British during World War II. It enabled the British to read all of the cipher messages of the German military, the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy, and that's how they used to deal with the submarines. And whatever the plans were, the Germans never believed that their Cyprus and their messages, their military communications, could be were being cracked and being read about the same time as they were being sent out, because the British had at Bletchley Park had the Ultra machines. The Germans suspected, but typical, I guess, Teutonic mentality. They just refused to believe that this could be happening, and it did happen. Same thing happened with Midway, where here in San Francisco, Naval Intelligence had a secret office where they were part of the plan and the operation to crack the Japanese, I think it was Navy codes, and they were able to do that. And it's in the film Midway, which incidentally stars Glenn Ford, who plays a Navy an admiral, Admiral Spruance, I think. With the carriers that were able to meet the Japanese at Midway and prevent Yamamoto from destroying the American, what was left of the American Navy, because we were still recovering from Pearl Harbor. And Spruance was able to get his planes off and just sink in the first battle three of the Japanese aircraft carriers, and then the fourth was also sunk. I think the Enterprise, one of our aircraft carriers, it was one for one in the final battle, but we came out ahead because the Japanese lost all their major aircraft carriers, including the aircraft carrier that from which the planes flew off that bombed Pearl Harbor in the USS Arizona. Fascinating story. Also, Carlton Heston was in it, and of course we have a common connection. He's dead. My speech teacher, I think she mentioned that she used to coach some of these people. One was Kim Novak, was actually ahead of me in her speech class, several years ahead of me, and then I think Rock Hudson was somebody she coached, Northwestern University connection, and I think Charlton Heston and a few others, quite a few actors who were coached by her, or they went to her, like Stella, who's a woman in Stella Adler in New York, who worked with Marlon Brando and several others. That kind of ties into what we're talking about, the Canadians who have come to the United States. Now, those of you, there's a great film about veterans who returned from World War II and how they had to readjust, or tried to readjust, to civilian life. And the guy who played the sailor who didn't have any hands, he was born, Harold Russell, was born in New Brunswick, which is the poorest province of Canada. And he had lost his hands, and he was in the Marines, and some explosives blew off his hands. But he recently died, as a matter of fact, but he emigrated to New England when he was a youth, and then joined the U.S. Marines. Also, the guy, those of you who were in the Army and handled the M1, that rifle was invented by a guy named John Garrard. It's called the Garrard Rifle. And he emigrated as a child to New England also. There's a lot of these French Canadians that go down there. And he went to work for one of the armory munitions manufacturers, and he was a very inventive man, dropped out of high school like Edison, and went to work. It was very skilled at designing his rifle and the successor rifles. And he never really got the credit he was due. Congress was supposed to grant him a $100,000 award, and they never fully got around to voting on it, to vote in Congress to grant the award. So he died, I think, in the 70s, but he emigrated from Canada. And then we had others. Raymond Massey had served in World War I, famous Canadian, Scotch-Canadian family, which owned Massey Ferguson, the world's biggest and richest tractor operation. They recently acquired John Deere, which was an Illinois tractor firm. But anyway, the Massey family was very prominent in eastern Canada. His brother, Vincent Massey, was Governor General of Canada. And Robert Massey had served, Raymond had served in the Canadian Army in World War I and had an ear injury. He emigrated to the United States, and he taught some military science or something down in one of the at Yale University. And then he got into the films, and he also later became an American citizen. But that's how he served. And we've had some other Canadians who've come down here. Oh, my favorite! Excuse me for forgetting. Victor Jory, J-O-R-Y, he, during World War I, he was born in the Yukon, which is a Canadian province, for those who don't know, and had this great voice, and here's another connection through media. He served in the United States Coast Guard, became an American, and was a boxer, and he, and after World War II, he was at the Pasadena Playhouse, where Ted Samuel, the late Ted Samuel, we'll get into his story, fascinating German-Jewish family, had come back from World War II. He had been a sergeant in Patton's army, and he had witnessed the forcible expatriation of Russian soldiers who had been captured by the American and British forces. And one of the deals at Yalta was Stalin demanded that all Russian prisoners of war, whether they wanted to or not, and none of them did, were to be sent back to Russia. And there's a lot of stories about things that happened. But anyway, Ted Samuel was a sergeant. He had served in Patton's army, and he was at the railroad station where they were forcibly pushing the these POWs, Russian POWs, onto the trains. Some guys committed suicide because they knew what fate they would be sent to concentration camps when they got back to Russia. And so he related that story to me. So after the war, Ted Samuel went to, on his GI Bill, went to the Pasadena Playhouse, and there he trained with Victor Jory. And Victor Jory, you'll see him, he had this great basso voice, baritone voice. He used to play the villain in some of these films. One of them was a prison film, Each Dawn I Die, and the great film of the 30s, and George Rapp's in it. And then those of you who remember Gone with the Wind, he played the evil, brutal overseer. That's Victor Jory. Another Canadian, Raymond Burr, was born in British Columbia. Family emigrated to Vallejo, California. He claimed, now there's some dispute about this, he, it's about the time of World War II, he claimed to have served in the U.S. Navy. There's a dispute about that. His mother said he was briefly in the Coast Guard, so we don't know. But anyway, you see him as playing Perry Mason in those old black and white segments. After World War II, he did star in a brutal prison film, which was about San Quentin. He recently died, and it came out that he had a long-time significant other, Latino fellow, who was his, I guess you could say, his lover. He was not an activist. He grew wine grapes, and this is how the story came out. But he also was Canadian. There were several other Canadians who served in our forces, and we'll get into them. Where are we now? Oh, yes. And then I think we have just those all. And now I have been going through the archives, and we're transferring stuff that we did for Western Public Radio, which was broadcast, some of it KLW, some of Western Public, where it was produced. We have an interview that I did with the Mahatma's grandnephew. And it's a three-part interview. We'll play the first part now. Where is it? Where is it? I just did this. Here we go. And this is interview part one.
Guest, the great grandnephew of Mahatma Gandhi, Yogesh K. Gandhi. Welcome to the programs.
Thank you.
What part of India are you from, sir?
I am coming from Gujarat state. It's West India.
India has seen a lot of changes in the last 30 years. Among the things that people in the United States think about your grand uncle, I'm getting that one confused. Wait a minute, let me rephrase that. Among the interesting things about the Mahatmas, would that be okay to say? Okay. Among the interesting things about the Mahatma was the things that he addressed to people concerning animals, that is, a society will be judged on how it treats its animals. Can you fill us in a little more on what the Mahatma thought about animals?
Mahatma Gandhi was thinking for animals also the same as he was thinking about the human being. And the main reason was to kill animals was also a part of violent for him and also for our Hindu religion and society. So he was considering animals also as a live, living
entity.
Entity, yes.
Okay. Worthy of respect.
Yes, with the respect.
Okay. The laws of Manu, do they still apply in modern India?
Certainly still it applies, but not in that manner what Mahatma Gandhi was expecting. And I think that is because of the lack of education in India, and also the different politicians.
In modern India today, have the Indians started to take more recognition of the, shall we say, the place of animals in their society? Do they have more respect for them?
Yes, yes, certainly. They have still more respect.
Okay. We see pictures of cows wandering in the street and they look diseased and that. Is that an accurate perception? Does that really happen in India today?
See, it is very difficult to say because not only animals, in India there are many, many people, those are also suffering from diseases, and that is because of the poverty, hunger. And when the human beings are not getting sufficient bread for themselves, how the human being can give also or provide to animals? And that's the one of the main objectives of the Gandhi Foundation, to provide and give homeless people home and food so they can take care about
themselves as well as the animals.
Right.
Does the cow or the cobra have any symbolic relationship to Hindu or modern Indian culture or society?
Yes, it is not only for the modern India, but cows is considered as a religious animal, and it comes from since last 5,000-6,000 years, and cow was a animal of God Lord Krishna, and snake was a animal for the Lord Shankar.
So the cobra represents something?
Yes, cobra also represents Lord Shankar, Shiva.
Okay. So Lord Shiva, now if I my what does Lord Shiva represent, Yogesh?
Lord Shiva represents also Hindu religion. There are, in Hindu religion, it's Vishnu, Shiva, and Krishna. There are the three major gods in our Hindu religion, and Shiva is one of them.
There is a growing debate in America and in the English-speaking world about the animal rights people and people who seem to put much more emphasis on the rights of animals, yet there is human suffering all around them. How can society strike a balance between the human suffering and gaining more respect for animals?
Be vegetarian.
That's the saint. You really mean that?
Yes, I really mean it. Be vegetarian. So we can take care about animals.
Well, that means that the whole Western economy is wrecked because we have feedlot cows and they're fed from grains And then the farm industries, I mean, you'll put all of the economic system out of it'll be in a whole state of disorder, the way things are set up.
See, when we believe in nonviolence and we believe that every human being has right to live in this planet, then the animals is also life. They have also right to live in this earth. And when we believe in nonviolence, so we have to stop to kill animals.
Is there any time that animals can be killed according to the teachings of of the Mahatma?
No, there was no time. I remember that and in the philosophy doesn't say to kill animals.
So I mean, like if a mad dog is threatening you, you're not supposed to kill it to defend yourself? If killing is the only way you can protect yourself?
It's question of education. Even how we educate, how we give the education to the mad people or mad human beings, the same kind of education we can give to the animals, and then they won't hurt to the society.
Okay. Any final tips, Yogesh?
No, I am not a specialist in animals, so I cannot give any final tip.
No, I mean, what you're doing right now, the peace thing, could you address that briefly?
Yes. I have founded Gandhi Memorial International Foundation to teach and promote the principles of truth, love, peace, and nonviolence. And we hope that in the next 20 years, peace and nonviolence become a dominant forces of the world. Not only that, we also hope that we will be able to end hunger and world peace in the next 20 years.
So your foundation, in working with humans, by extension also, the principles can extend to the animal kingdom.
Certainly.
Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
This is Peter Paul speaking to the great-grandnephew of the Mahatma Gandhi, Yogesh K. Gandhi. Thanks for listening. This is Peter Paul.
Now, there's two more parts to this, a long interview. It's the way I usually break things up. So we've broken them up. And we also have another great former president of the university, author, came from Canada also, born in Canada, Otto Butz, interesting comments and observations on animals and politics. Also, we didn't spend too much time, we didn't get to this, but I should bring it up. One of the crazy things, everybody, Hannity and other people, are picking on San Francisco, and for good reason. We've got a lot of copperbackers from back east and from the south and from other countries who have come to the Paris, once Paris of America, and turn it into a pissoir. The latest outrage, vote fraud, what I call Election Day vote fraud, it's on our ballot here in San Francisco City and County to allow same-day voter registration and voting. And we've had so much vote fraud. I mean, this is blatant. And I hope everybody who's thinking, and people should think, and more that we've been, this is another disenfranchisement. There's no way to verify these people. We already have illegal aliens who have voted and gotten away with it. We also have Americans who have voted twice in different areas of the state, in what was called the Macarena Express back during when Al Gore was running against George Bush. We also have on a ballot right next to it, this is BS, where non-citizens, which is illegal, can vote for school board members, and this is another disenfranchisement, and this has got to stop. I understand they've tried to do this or may have successfully done it in a couple other American cities, but you know, the whole idea is if you're coming to America, you're coming here, you want to participate in our politics, you should become a citizen and register to vote properly when you're legally a U.S. citizen. So we're going to end real quick with, and we'll get into this Sunday. We're doing a Sunday and a Tuesday interview. So we'll end with my favorite political song.
Hey, Ben, want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Fine.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year. Big Ace.
Ace Betts.
You'll pay through the nose.
And we'll pay through the nose if, unless we get some good candidates in there, and I still feel that Morris and Luntz, you know, real, they may be naive about vote fraud. So go to our website, our YouTube site, Amicus Veritas, AmicusVeritas, and we're updating it. We'll have some stuff on vote fraud, how they got away with it here in San Francisco, which is one of the models for political corruption across the country. This is Peter Paul Brizola. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you for listening, and this is Archive. Good night. Mm-hmm.